77 WABC. The following program does not necessarily reflect the views of WABC Radio.
The following program is brought to you by NYU Winthrop Hospital. It's the weekend. Be good to yourself. It's Katz's Corner with Dr. Aaron Katz, where you get simple, straightforward answers to your questions about health, from diet and supplements to lifestyle changes. To reach Dr. Katz, call 800-848-WABC. Now, live on 77 WABC, it's the chairman of urology at NYU Winthrop Hospital in New York. Here is Dr. Aaron Katz.
Good morning. And if you're a regular listener, you'll realize that this is not Dr. Katz. My name is Dr. Colin Brathwaite. I'm chairman of the Department of Surgery at NYU Winthrop. Dr. Katz is out today, and I will be filling in for him. We're fortunate to have today two doctors also from Winthrop who will be talking about the topic of hernias, and I'll introduce them in a minute. Hernias are a problem that many people deal with, both men and women. And first in the studio, we have Dr. Kenneth Hall, who's a faculty attending at Winthrop in general and minimally invasive surgery, also bariatric surgery. Dr. Hall is also the director of the surgical simulation at Winthrop, and he's here live in the studio with us. Good morning, Dr. Hall.
Good morning, Dr. Brathwaite.
And on the phone, we have dialing in Dr. David Halpern. Dr. Halpern is also an attending in general surgery at Winthrop. He is active in minimally invasive surgery as well. He also does breast surgery, but his practice is generally in general surgery. Dr. Halpern is also assistant clinical professor at Stony Brook in the School of Medicine, and he's also currently president of the Medical Staff Organization, so he wears a lot of hats. And both of these doctors today will be talking about the subject of hernias. Are you there, Dr. Halpern?
Yes. Good morning, Colin. How are you?
Okay, good. Morning, good. Thanks for waking up so early and calling
sure.
in. So, you know, what is a hernia? That's a question that patients often will ask if they come in and you see them in the office. Dr. Hall, what is a hernia? Can you just tell us a little bit about this?
Well, first of all, there are several types of hernias, but for the purposes of this talk, a hernia can be defined as a weakness or a defect in the anterior abdominal wall. It is often seen as a protrusion or a bulge and sometimes contain fat, intestines, or other organs. Now, they can be further defined by the location in the body in which they are found, such as the inguinal region, which relates to groin hernias, or epigastric areas for the upper abdomen, or also an umbilical hernias, which refer to the hernias in the belly button and so forth.
The hernia in the navel.
Yes, right. That's correct. Now, other people have described them, and they can be further classified as reducible, which means that you can easily push them back in, as often patients do from time to time. Incarcerated describes the types of hernia which are not reducible. In other words, you have difficulty putting them back in once they protrude. And lastly, strangulated hernias. These are the ones that are more severe, more often associated with other conditions and sometimes become entrapped. And oftentimes, they're a sign of that the tissue is actually dying. So these are very urgent and often requires our attention.
Thanks, Dr. Hall. So, Dr. Halpern, you heard a little bit about hernias from Dr. Hall. How serious is a hernia? This is a question I often have with patients. Is this serious? Do I have to do anything about it? How serious is a hernia?
Yeah. So, I mean, as Ken had said, Dr. Hall had said, definitely a hernia can be a serious condition if it becomes incarcerated or strangulated. But generally, it's not something that someone should be scared to have fixed. Most patients come in with a bulge. They're having symptoms. It's bothering them. And these are things that are easily repaired. Patients should expect to get back to normal activity, get back to a full life afterwards. We can do these repairs with really very low morbidity. We get good recurrence rates, meaning that usually it's a permanent fix. The recurrence rates are less than 1%. And we're even able to offer these repairs to patients who are up in their years, patients who are frail and elderly, We have patients coming into the office in their 80s and 90s with inguinal hernias and they're suffering. And we can use techniques such as IV sedation and local anesthesia. And we send these patients home the same day and they do very well. So although they can be serious medical conditions, generally it's something that's easily corrected and patients go on to do very well and live a normal life.
So I do have a question about something you mentioned just to make sure our audience is educated as we go along. You used two terms I would like you to elaborate on a little bit. You said it could be incarcerated or strangulated. What would that mean?
Sure. So a hernia, as Dr. Hall had mentioned, is a hole in the abdominal wall muscle through which the intra-abdominal organs will protrude. So a patient will notice a lump in their abdomen. Now, usually we can push the lump in and out. So the lump might get painful, and the patient can lie down and push the lump back in. We call that reducing the hernia. If something falls through the hole in the abdominal wall and gets stuck there, we call that incarcerated. In other words, it's kind of locked up or incarcerated in the hole, and it can't be reduced. If something becomes acutely incarcerated or suddenly gets stuck in the hole, then the blood supply can get compromised. It's almost as if it's being strangled or choked off, and that's what we call a strangulated hernia. So the lump, not only can it not be reduced or put back in, but the patient might notice a painful lump, a red lump. They may have some associated nausea and vomiting, and that's a sign that they need to get to the hospital right away.
So if someone has what you described as incarceration or strangulation, they definitely need to get to the hospital, get to their doctor as soon as possible, all right?
They sure should.
Dr. Hall, do hernias go away on their own? Sometimes patients say to me, well, doc, do I have to have this fixed?
I often ask these questions. Patients ask me that oftentimes when they see me in the office. The short answer is hernias do not go away on their own, and they certainly cannot fix themselves. Some people, however, may have alleviation of their symptoms temporarily, but that's probably because it became reduced, either by them reducing it or spontaneously. Being reduced, and sometimes there's no longer the associated pain. Most of these patients, once they become symptomatic, will ultimately benefit from some sort of surgical intervention, and some of which we'll talk about later on during the show.
Okay, and, you know, patients will ask, well, doc, can I die from this hernia? Some patients are reluctant to have surgery. What do you think, Dr. Halperin? What would you say in that situation?
So can you die from a hernia? Unfortunately, you can. It's not common, but if someone comes in or doesn't present and they have a strangulated hernia and they sit at home with it, eventually that sepsis will set in. In other words, whatever has protruded through and become strangulated becomes gangrenous. They'll get a bad infection, and it'll spread throughout the body. That's not to say that a strangulated hernia cannot be repaired, because we see patients come into the ER, I would say, at least on a monthly basis with strangulated hernias, and we repair them, and they go home, and they do fine. But they don't do as well as if they've come in electively and had their hernias repaired. They have higher recurrence rates. They've undergone more surgery than they would have needed to. So generally, it's better to fix them before it becomes an emergency. It's better for the patient, easier for us, and better outcomes overall.
Well, that's good. You know, one of my patients gave me a book recently that talks about medical myths and quackeries in medicine over the last several hundred years. And one of them, as I looked through it, it said that one of the treatments for hernias, of course, several hundred years ago, was actually giving an enema. Now, of course, we know today that we know that that does not work. So you need some type of surgery to fix it. So let's talk about certain types of hernia. Let's talk now a little bit about, Dr. Hall, you mentioned inguinal hernias or groin hernias. Just tell us a little bit more about that.
Well, first of all, the inguinal hernias now have become one of the most common procedures that we fix, general surgeons in this country fix. In fact, approximately 800,000 to 900,000 hernia repairs are done each year. In general, it's much more common in men. In fact, approximately 25% of men and less than 2% of women will develop inguinal hernias over their lifetime. So yes, there's a clear difference in, as it relates to the occurrences in men versus women. And that could be for several different reasons. Some of it is largely unknown, but it can also be related to the activity. Men in general tend to, according to some studies, lift more. Sometimes the jobs may demand a higher amount of abdominal stress, and that can also lead to increased incidence of hernias. Also, as it relates to the anatomy, a patent processus vaginalis, which is a natural defect in the anterior abdominal wall in the groin, at some point becomes weakened, especially with excess force, and that predisposes men in general to inguinal hernias.
So, and what you just mentioned refers to, just to explain a little bit, the as men, as the child develops in the woman, right at the time they're born, the testicles go down into the scrotum, and so that space may be left open, and that may predispose some men to a hernia. But you also see hernias in women as well.
Right? That's correct.
Okay. What are the ways to repair a hernia, and why should it be repaired? Just to emphasize again, Dr. Halpern.
So I think we pretty much hit why it should be repaired, right? Because we don't want to wind up in the emergency room looking for a surgeon at 2 in the morning. But how do we fix a hernia? That's a whole other ballgame. So there's traditionally two repairs. There's a tissue repair, which involves just closing the hole with sutures, and then there's a mesh repair. And tissue repairs have been around since the 1800s, and they've certainly advanced. The mainstay of hernia repair today, particularly groin hernias, does involve placing a prosthetic mesh. And there's laparoscopic approaches as well as open approaches. The advantage to using mesh is that it offers a much diminished recurrence rate. So the recurrence rates with mesh repairs, whether they're open or laparoscopic, are usually less than 1%, whereas with tissue repairs, they can be sometimes 7 or 8-fold higher, depending on how it's done and the anatomy of the patient. So that's not to say that everyone needs a mesh. There are some instances where if the defect is small or the abdominal musculature allows it, we can simply do a tissue repair and still get great results.
So, and one of the, about 30 years ago, I think it was very common for people to go for what's called the Canadian repair. That does not involve mesh, right?
Correct, right. So the shoulder ice repair is a layered repair with a continuous suture, and they actually use a wire suture, is originally the way to
shoulder ice. That's right, the traditional type.
Yeah, yeah. But if you notice, not to criticize shoulder ice, because they have great results, but one thing that they do is they kind of select their patients. They talk about something called height to body weight ratio, and they want their patients to be kind of thin. And most of our patients today are not, unfortunately, thin. So,
right.
You know, whether shoulder ice repair applies to the general population, I'm sure if you use that repair in the general population, the results would not be as good as a standard mesh repair.
Okay. Dr. Hall, let's talk about open versus laparoscopic versus robotic, just in general terms, because patients often have questions about these.
Well, there's a number of studies looking at this. In general, outcomes are very similar in all groups. But as it relates to hospital stay, postoperative pain, time to return to work, and to resume to regular activities, these are all less in the laparoscopic group as well as in the robotic group. Additionally, there are other studies that compare laparoscopic to robotic approach. And some of those studies have also shown, at least initially, that there has been a reduction in pain in the robotic group versus the laparoscopic group. That has also been my experience. I do a great deal of robotic inguinal hernia surgeries at Winthrop. And my experience has been most of these patients have way less pain compared to the laparoscopic group. Could also be related to the fact that no tacks are placed or into the anterior abdominal wall, which could cause a lot of pain. And also there's less dissection that is due with the robotic surgery, which ultimately leads to less inflammation and reduction of what you call postoperative seroma or fluid collections, as well as hematomas, which are collection of blood, all of which can increase the complication rates in these patients and also increase their length of stay and pain. So because of that, at least in my hands, the patients with robotic inguinal hernia repair do slightly better compared to the laparoscopic team.
Okay, if you're just tuning in, my name is Dr. Colin Brathwaite. I'm filling in for Dr. Katz. Dr. Katz's corner today, and our guests are Dr. Kenneth Hall, a faculty attending and general surgeon at NYU Winthrop, and also Dr. Dave Halpern, another general surgeon from NYU Winthrop, and we're talking about hernias. Now, Dr. Halpern, what about incisional or ventral hernias? That's another type. We just heard a little bit about groin hernias. What about incisional ventral hernias? That's another type that's fairly common.
Correct, yeah. So incisional hernias occur along a midline abdominal wall incision. So patients who have had prior surgery, unfortunately about 20% of these patients will develop hernias. And the difference between these is not in the location, but sometimes they behave differently. Often they'll get larger and continue to get larger, and repairing them when they get very large can be quite complex. There are a lot of factors that can cause incisional hernias. Some of it can be attributed to the surgical technique used to close during the original operation, but some of them are also patient factors. So patients who are morbidly obese, patients who have who smoke, patients who, unfortunately, may be on immunosuppressants, may be on steroids, patients who may have received preoperative chemotherapy, patients who have chronic cough. These are all risk factors for developing incisional hernias, as well as patients who develop wound infections or wound hematomas and seromas, as Dr. Hall had mentioned during their original surgery. These can predispose patients to developing incisional hernias.
Well, that's good, and it's almost like you identified some factors that we can address prior to the patient having the hernia repair. So if someone has obesity, trying to lose some weight before the repair, if someone is diabetic, trying to get their sugars under control, if there's an ongoing infection, trying to clean that up. And one that you touched upon, smoking, is a significant risk as well because it compromises wound healing.
Absolutely, yeah. And we always encourage our patients to stop smoking. And weight loss is a big factor, but unfortunately we don't always win the battle with weight loss, and we sometimes wind up operating when we'd rather not. And I think that's where laparoscopic and robotic surgery really shines and shows its advantages.
Okay. So it seems like some hernias may be riskier than others or some types of repairs. Dr. Hall, you want to comment on that?
Oh, yes, definitely. Well, again, it all depends on how the patient present, the location of the hernia, and what's going on with that patient. Some hernias obviously have a higher urgency, and some patients, for example, a strangulated hernia. If a patient presents with a strangulated hernia, these patients need to be taken to the operating room in a much swifter fashion compared to a reducible hernia, for example, which can be done electively. There are some hernias which are located in certain locations on the anterior abdominal wall, which are at a higher risk for strangulation and incarceration. And oftentimes these are diagnosed and imaging such as ultrasound or CAT scans. And these, when they are found, are often repaired because there's a greater chance that these may perforate and cause other issues. So these are, for example, Spigelian hernias, or hernia that's found in the simplest form to explain, just to the left or right of the lateral edge of the external oblique and the rectus muscles. And for that reason, there's a high risk that that bowel could die, and these patients are often ultimately identified quickly in imaging and taken to the operating room to reduce the complications. So some of those hernias require greater a level and high index of suspicion, and these should be more addressed. Dr. Halpern also touched on some of the risk factors of what can be done to optimize some of these patients, and also certain patient factors, as he mentioned before, would preclude us to going sooner rather than later to the operating room.
Okay. Dr. Halpern, umbilical hernias, what about those? Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Sure. So belly button hernia or an umbilical hernia is the medical term. And these actually are more common in females than men, as opposed to the inguinal hernias that Dr. Hall had mentioned earlier. And some of this may be embryologic in origin, but we're just not sure. The don't all necessarily need to be fixed. Certainly if a patient's symptomatic and the hernia is bothering them, definitely they should be fixed. But if the defect is small and if what we call the hernia sac, or the area that things can protrude into, is shallow, or they have an associated kind of separation of muscles that kind of blends in with the anatomy of the hernia, we may elect to just watch these patients. And I think it's important to select the patients carefully, because one thing we do know about umbilical hernias is that if they recur, they tend to recur larger and more symptomatic than they were originally. So definitely you want to select your patients properly, make sure you're operating for the right indication, and you want to make sure you do a good repair so that they don't recur. What else about umbilical hernias? I mean, certainly risk factors, like any other hernias, constipation, women when they get pregnant, anything that increases the abdominal pressure, patients who have a chronic cough, these are all risk factors.
Okay. Let me just mention, again, we're speaking with Dr. Kenneth Hall and Dr. David Halpern, both from NYU Winthrop. Dr. Halpern's office number, if you have questions after the show, is 516-741-4138, 516-741-4138. And Dr. Hall has offices in Garden City and in Patchogue on Long Island, 631-475-1900 in Patchogue, and in Garden City, 516-663-1430, 516-663-1430. Now, just briefly, Dr. Halpern, I know we're not going to get into great detail on this one today, hiatal hernias. I think Dr. Katz wants us to do another show on that specifically because it's such a big problem. But hiatal hernias, can you just touch on those for our audience?
Sure. A hiatal hernia is actually not an abdominal wall hernia, but a herniation of the abdominal wall contents, the intra-abdominal contents into the chest. And most commonly, it's the stomach that herniates into the chest. So it's not something that we see visibly. Patients present with reflux-type symptoms, difficulty swallowing, and it's something that's diagnosed with an upper endoscopy or an upper GI series. A lot of patients mistake a hiatal hernia for what's called a rectus diastasis, and the two are very different. A diastasis is a separation of the abdominal wall, and patients come into the office, and a lot of times they call their diastasis a hiatal hernia. And the separation can occur after pregnancy or men who are obese, or just over time the muscles will tend to migrate apart. And what they notice is when they try and do a sit-up, the abdominal wall muscles will flex, but the fascia in the midline kind of bows out, so they see like a big bulge in the midline. And that's a diastasis, which is distinguished from a hiatal hernia.
Right, right. Now, Dr. Hall, you mentioned in some of your discussions about meshes, and that's something I encounter often. Patients will come in and you tell them that they need a hernia repair, and they say flat out, "I don't want any mesh." What's the big deal about mesh, and how, is mesh important? Do hernias need to be repaired with mesh?
Well, that's a very hot topic these days. Well, it's well known that without mesh reinforcement, many of these hernia recurrences will be unacceptably high. Prior to the 1990s, many hernia repair was being done just with suturing, as Dr. Halpern spoke about. But in fact, I've seen a number of patients in the past several years who have had these types of repairs, and they are presented with recurrences and ultimately have to be fixed. In most of these cases, the mesh will increase the strength of the wound by reducing the tension. It also provides a scaffold through which the tissues can grow. Now, the choice of the mesh is usually surgeon-dependent, but often guided by what's going on with the patient. For example, there are two main categories of meshes. They're biologic and synthetic. The biologic meshes are those derived from living tissues, and these are typically will be resorbed after a set period of time, for example, 1 year. The synthetic meshes are permanent. Now, meshes are foreign bodies and obviously must be used on a case-by-case basis, and at times they can become infected and sometimes need to be removed. It is important to note that the meshes we use today, however, are for the most part very safe and highly selected, and again, they're put in on a case-by-case basis. Ultimately, for most of these hernias, anything, for example, that's greater than 3 centimeters will benefit from some type of a mesh repair.
And so I want to emphasize one thing that you said, so for our audience, that meshes are very important, and without using a mesh to reinforce the hernia repair, the chance of recurrence is extremely high. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Yeah. Okay. And one of the areas that we really wanted to touch upon today, and we hope to elaborate on a little bit more, Dr. Halperin, I'll ask you about this robotic repairs. We heard about the different types of hernias and different types of repair. What about the robot? Because this is becoming so popular today.
Yeah. So I think the robot definitely shines in certain particular areas. And what I've found is where it really shines in the field of abdominal wall reconstruction. So there are some hernias, we didn't talk, unfortunately, too much about ways to repair hernias, but usually we just close the hole and kind of slap a mesh on it, or either underneath it or over it. And we know there are some hernias that can't be repaired that way. Sometimes the hernia defect's too large, the patient may have failed prior repairs, they may have an associated diastasis or separation, and these patients will definitely fail a mesh repair, whether it's done with an underlay or an overlay. What they really require is something called abdominal wall reconstruction or abdominal wall component separation. And what that involves is separating the abdominal wall musculature from its native attachments and kind of shifting it over the defect and reinforcing that with a mesh. So the open surgery for this definitely has a long tried and true track record. But the robotic surgery that's been developed over the past few years is the exact same surgery, but has some big advantages. And I think one of the big advantages is that it has a markedly decreased wound infection rate. With the open repairs, the patients are having a big, long midline incision. They have multiple drains in place, whereas with the robotic surgery, they're going home usually the day after the operation with 4 to 6 small half-inch incisions on the abdominal wall. Additionally, the length of stay in the hospital is dramatically reduced. So with the open surgery, a lot of the patients are in the hospital from 4 to 6 days, whereas we see our patients going home the day or the day after of the operation. So it's something we're able to offer them with decreased morbidity, decreased length of stay, and the same good long-term durability of repair.
That's great. And since we're getting close to our time here, I'll ask Dr. Hall, how about robotic repairs for groin hernias? That has become increasingly popular as well.
That's correct. Now, I'm aware that there's some new studies showing that there's some superiority as it relates to repairing these robotically. Most of it is not yet published. However, in my own experience, I've seen that because of this improved high definition, this great visibility, and also that coupled with the wristed instruments that robotics affords, I find that my movements are much more precise, there's less collateral damage, which ultimately translates to less pain and a reduction in complications. So I've found that there's a slight advantage of doing robotic inguinal hernias over laparoscopic and even definitely over open cases as it relates to the complication rates.
Okay, well, our time is coming to a close, and again, I want to reiterate that we've had Dr. Kenneth Hall and Dr. Dave Halperin. Dr. Halperin's office number, if you have follow-up questions, is 516-741-4138, and Dr. Hall can also be seen at 516-663-1430. My name is Dr. Colin Brathwaite, Chairman of Surgery at NYU Winthrop, and filling in for Dr. Katz, who I think will be back next week. Thank you for tuning in.
WABC, New York.